Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Hey, this is Sound Effect from KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and on this midweek episode of our podcast, we are going to be taking a deeper dive into one of the stories that we aired on a recent program. We're going to give it a listen. It was on our show around the theme of Watch Your Language. And I'm joined by Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad. Hello, Kevin.
Hello.
And we're just going to give it a listen, talk a little bit about it, and hear a bunch more that, a bunch of bonus content that those suckers who only listen on the weekends will never get.
They don't know what they're missing.
All right. So here it is, this story from our show on Watch Your Language from Sound Effect on KNKX. Soli Mora Cogley is a musician in Seattle and the leader of the band Soli Mora and the Strange Kind.
I've always been into music since I was really little. I was always playing keyboards at like 2 years old. My mom had a keyboard. I was playing music and picking up guitars and whatever I could get my hands on. And so music, I think, really helped to move me in a more social direction, because I didn't really do a lot of talking when I was little, but I developed a communication skill using music that made me fit into different groups. So I didn't have to have conversations. I was just playing music.
Using music as a sort of language and way to communicate is helpful to Soli because Soli has autism. They didn't always know that. In fact, they weren't diagnosed with autism until they were 30. Soli sat down with Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad to talk about growing up undiagnosed, how musicians have helped Soli communicate, and what they call offstage fright.
You know, I was always the kid that got picked on first, you know. I had a few friends in school that were kind of like me. You know, we were a little bit less cool and less, you know, whatever that is, you know, whatever people say cool is, we definitely weren't it. You know, I'm 39 years old, and, you know, in all my younger years, autism wasn't the subject. Autism wasn't something that was even thought about, because to them at that time, autism was nonverbal. It was, if you were verbal, you were Rain Man. So being verbal and being, you know, kind of more masking as neurotypical tends to get overlooked and misdiagnosed with other things. Like a sensory processing disorder is one of the most common diagnoses that doesn't quite diagnose autism. They're like, oh, you have a sensory processing disorder. Oh, you have ADHD. Oh, you also have OCD. Oh, you have bipolar disorder. Oh, dissociative identity disorder, because you change your personality based on the situation that you're in. And it becomes this big, you know, just cluster of things that you kind of fit a little bit, but they don't take the time to realize that all those things put together are also autism.
So were some of those things being thrown at you at that age?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. When I was little, I was, you know, they didn't quite know what it was. So I was going to a lot of therapy and just trying to figure out, you know, and also, you know, I had gender issues and things like that, which is also pretty common with girls on the spectrum, because we're not quite, you know, the girly girls and things like that. But in my case, I'm also intersex, which is neither male or female. So I talk about that a little bit. This is actually kind of one of the first times I'm opening up about it on the radio. So in 2011, I had surgery. And they put me on a medication for pain that they don't normally put people with neurological conditions on if they have a diagnosed neurological condition. But because I didn't, they put me on a medication that reacted with my brain. And so I basically wound up with a chemical TBI.
TBI.
Traumatic brain injury. And so that brought forth a lot of vocal and motor tics that were really uncontrollable at the time. So having that happen was one of the things that actually helped get me diagnosed with my autism, because that was something right there that showed I had a neurological condition, which autism is a neurological condition.
Well, switching gears a tad.
Yeah.
Let's go back to music. When did you start to realize that music was a way to communicate?
Yeah. So when I was younger, this was probably more in the high school years, The doctors did tell my mom that I used the side of my brain that most people use for language for music, that I think musically. I use it like a language, and I use it in a way that helps me to think the way that you would if you're learning a language.
Can you give me some examples of exactly how that worked for you?
Writing songs, because writing songs, being able to learn how to express yourself, your feelings verbally, and so writing poetry and writing, you know, creating these songs and expressing the feeling of not just with words, but with production.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing is that I did over time, you know, find bands that were obviously of my era that I knew who they were. So, I mean, I was in love with the Cranberries. I was personally influenced by Dolores and the words, the lyrics, more so than anything, because I related so much to those lyrics.
Is there anything that stands out to you in particular?
Oh, Daffodil Lament was one that really, really stuck with me, because it's kind of like that balance of, it's like a happy song, like the music is very kind of chimey and happy, but the lyrics are very kind of like depressing and like talking about like you're just waiting for the icicles to melt, and you're waiting for these things to happen, and waiting for that, you know, for like the other shoe to drop, basically. But then you're looking around, and don't the daffodils look lovely today, you know? It's like that kind of where I was at in my mindset when I first heard the Cranberries, you know, because I had been so isolated isolated socially, because I wasn't fitting in. And the people that I did fit in with were also people that didn't feel like they fit in. Mm. And then later in life, it was Ani DeFranco, and it was, you know, Sarah McLachlan, and it was Sheryl Crow or whatever. And I would take personality traits that I admired in them and then made them a part of who I was. So I learned how to mimic certain things until they became a part of myself, and then discovered who I was through these amazing people that just influenced who I am today. You know, and finding Ani DeFranco's music, that helped me to be a little bit tougher.
I am walking out in the rain, and I am listening to the low moan of the dial tone again, and I am getting nowhere with you, and I can't let it go, and I can't get through.
Ani's just no holds bars,
yeah.
Say what you need to say kind of attitude, which was a striking contrast to the social learning that I had done as a kid.
What is it about being on stage that's different than being off stage? Because there's certainly elements in being on stage that you can't control, say crowd noise, lights, etc. So can you, first of all, tell me what the difference, what offstage fright is, and how it's different for you when you're on stage?
So offstage fright is just more of, I have zero control over my environment. I'm going to be more on edge when I'm in a crowd of people that I don't know. On stage, I have complete control over who is up there with me. And every person that is allowed up there on that stage with me is a very close friend and somebody that I've already had social interactions with, and I know that they're not judging me.
Mm-hmm. But of course, no one needs to be your friend to buy a ticket.
No.
So how does the crowd factor into that at all?
The crowd on stage, you're not looking at an individual person in the crowd. You're looking at a crowd of people that are there to listen to music. And so I don't even try to think about what they're thinking, you know?
Yeah.
And so that takes a lot of that stress off of trying to figure people out. And so I think on stage, I'm able to look out at that crowd and for just, you know, that time that I'm on stage, I'm not processing. I'm not trying to read body language or any of that stuff. The most I'm trying to gauge is how into the music are they? you know, and at the same time, not trying to push people to come up to the front of the stage, because a lot of the people that do come to my shows are on the spectrum as well. And maybe they don't want to be up in the crowd of people. So I've learned how to not take things personally if people aren't coming up to the front of the stage.
Yeah.
So it's all a different kind of social interaction when you're on stage versus when you're in that crowd of people and people aren't interacting with you.
Is there a way that you hope that your music is translated by the listener?
I obviously, when you write a song, you're coming from one perspective, but I also try to let go of my own perspective when I'm writing a song, so that I can say things that maybe mean multiple other things to other people. So, like, I try not to think about what that is that they're interpreting, you know, because I think very literally. So my literalness might be translated by somebody else in a very non-literal way.
And that's okay.
And that's okay with me. I'm okay with that, as long as they can understand that I'm coming from a very literal place. So, like, I have a song called Black Dog Like a Ghost, you know, and I literally saw dogs with black cameras on their heads. But somebody else might hear that and think something else, you know? And so it's more of like, I can't focus on what that other person is thinking it means, you know? Because that's their interpretation. If it helps them through something, or if it helps them feel better thinking their interpretation, I have no place in telling them how to feel about that song. But literally, that is a prime example of being very literal in writing.
So you just, if you don't mind talking about this, you just had surgery on your throat.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a singer, obviously. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have any concerns about that having any effect on the way you're able to communicate through music.
I don't, because, I mean, I've been, you know, obviously I can't sing today because when I try to hit my high notes right now, it sounds like dying cats, but it's just a matter of, I have to re-strengthen those muscles again. So it is a little difficult right now. I was really scared when I went in for surgery, thinking, oh, I might not be able to sing again.
That had to be, I mean, even if the doctors are giving you all the assurance you could possibly want, that had to still, as a singer.
I made the doctor put my CD on while he was operating. I'm like, this is incentive to not F it up. But it was a joke. Like, I gave it to him as a joke, but they actually did put it on. So I was able to fall asleep to my bandmates, woke up, and it was all over. Like it had just been like 2 seconds.
Wow.
So,
are you close with your parents?
I'm very close with my parents.
Do they listen to your music?
All the time. My mom is like my biggest number one fan.
Do you feel that any of your music helps them translate and understand you more now?
I think it does in certain ways. My mom has grown a lot over the years. It doesn't matter what issue it is, whether it's my, you know, understanding my autism or coming to terms with the fact that, you know, my gender issues and things like that, you know, obviously we've talked about all that stuff. So we've had a chance to, just growing older, things change, you know. So whether it was music or not, we were gonna come to a place of understanding, because we're always coming from a place of love.
Home is where I'm from, is where I go.
That was Soli Morikagli talking with sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad for our show on Watch Your Language. And Kevin's with me now. Kevin, you guys had a long conversation, and I can only imagine the stuff that didn't make it into the final cut for the show.
Yeah, a lot of it had to do with how Soli used certain things as coping mechanisms. We heard in the story that Soli uses a part of their brain that a lot of people use for language. Soli uses it for music and is able to communicate a little bit easier with that sort of musical side of the brain. But also, Soli uses that part of the brain to cope by using accents and kind of picking up on other people's personality traits and incorporating that, and found that a way that that kind of a way to be able to express themselves.
So that's something that can be tricky for people with autism, right? Because those sorts of social cues are hard to identify and get a handle on. But it sounds like Soli has kind of gotten a workaround through music.
Yeah, and this was kind of a lifelong thing too. Soli was using would pick up on accents that they would hear other people use, like an Irish accent or a British accent or a Canadian accent. And by sort of channeling other people in the way they sound, because they say that everything is so tonal for them, that it was easier to communicate. It was easier to fit into groups for Soli, just feel more comfortable socially.
I had, you know, some stuttering, and I had some things that I had dealt with since childhood that I had coped with. I had, you know, these coping mechanisms that made it really easy to not tick, to not stutter.
Like what?
Well, I mean, I didn't realize what the coping mechanisms were at the time, because at the time I just had grown up doing these things that would help me, and I didn't realize what it was. So as an adult, I had to relearn those things. So one of the things that I relearned how to do was accents is a big thing. And that's more recent that I started kind of realizing that accent, and changing your accent uses a musical part of your brain. So I tend to put on like a little slight Canadian, but just slight enough that I'm thinking in an accent that's not my natural one.
Is it intentional?
It's slightly intentional. Mm-hmm. At this point, it's become more unintentional than intentional, but my brain is still thinking in a tonal way. So doing that has helped me so that I don't stutter. I can speak faster. You know, when I was a kid, my mom told me that I used to speak in an Irish accent whenever we would go to grocery stores or places like that. So thinking about that, those were things that I was doing as a child that made me function at a level that people just thought I was like, neurotypical, you know?
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, again, how did that sort of come about? How did speaking in an Irish accent as a kid, I mean, how did you develop that? I mean,
I hear things in a tonal way. You know, that's mm-hmm. just how my brain works. And not everybody works like that. Some people, you know, are visual, and some people are mathematical, you know. Mm-hmm. And so for me, tones work. And for me, you know, I have tons of pictures of me looking like Dolores from the Cranberries and trying to be her, because that was the only way that I could fit into a group of people and have a conversation, was the Irish accent. Again, mm-hmm. came back. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, it came back again because it was easy for me. I mean, I loved all that stuff, you know. But looking back, you know, I did that. I did take on personality traits to help me kind of find my way in the music community, more so than just playing music.
Wow.
So yeah.
That is so interesting. I mean, I've heard in different contexts about people who have difficulty with verbal skills, being able to still access the parts of the brain that operate in music. So that's why some people who can't talk can still sing and stuff like mm-hmm. that. But I had never heard of somebody kind of tricking their brain into thinking it was singing, essentially, in order to speak more fluently.
I think that's a pretty good example of how music isn't just songs necessarily, that it's like Sully said, it's tonal. So it's just a sound. It's language and an accent almost as music, you know, not in song form, but you know, something along those lines.
Yeah. And then what they were saying about sort of dressing like the lead singer of the Cranberries mm-hmm. in order to fit in. And that's something I think we can all identify with across mm-hmm. the neurological spectrum. But with them, it became really a survival strategy.
Yeah. Yeah, it really did. And still, I think, probably to some degree remains one. Certainly music and singing remains one for Soli. But I would imagine some of those coping mechanisms still exist, and outside of just simply singing, and they probably will exist for maybe the rest of their life.
It's a fascinating subject and a really not only an interesting interview subject, but a really great musician, too. Is there a little bit of their music that you could play to kind of take us out today?
Yeah. Soli's band is called Soli Mora and the Strange Kind, and this is their tune, Run.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kevin.
You bet.
All right. For Kevin Canista and the rest of the Sound Effect crew, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Make sure to tune in this weekend for the next episode of Sound Effect. And in the meantime, enjoy this tune from Soli Mora and the Strange Kind.